Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 509, titled The Death of Iris Chang. This is being recorded on May 1st of the year 2005. We're going to be taking a look at the circumstances surrounding the alleged suicide of author Iris Chang, best known for her work on The Rape of Nanking. That was a major World War II atrocity in which the Japanese army in 1937 slew perhaps 350,000 Chinese in Nanking, the capital of China at that time. It wasn't just that the victims were killed, but they were done to death up close and personal. They were shot, beheaded, bayoneted, buried alive. The initial orders to the Japanese executioners were such, they were told not to waste ammunition by shooting the victims, but eventually they began shooting them simply because the executioners were exhausted from bayonet thrusts and from beheading victims with samurai swords. So they began shooting them. But it was one of the greatest atrocities in World War II history. Again, some 350,000, by most counts, Chinese were done to death. And Iris Chang, a Chinese-American author, had written a landmark text called The Rape of Nanking. And that had, as we're going to see, that drew a lot of fire to Iris Chang. She received a lot of death threats. Those death threats apparently moved her considerably. It did not, however, deter her. She continued to investigate some of the ramifications of Japan's World War II atrocities, and specifically had been chronicling the stories of the survivors of the Bataan Death March. Some of those survivors had filed lawsuits, class action lawsuits, against Japan, demanding compensation for their use as slave laborers. And as we're going to see, the whole issue of Japanese corporations being forced to compensate various World War II opponents for using their POWs as slave labor is a very, very big issue indeed. This is the case for a couple of reasons. Cold War politics has a lot to do with it, and also, even more perhaps, multinational corporate economics and politics. During the course of the Cold War, not only were many of the Japanese fascists simply put right back in power in order to use them in an anti-communist capacity in the Cold War, but in addition, the Japanese government and its politicians and corporations were allowed to keep and utilize the billions upon billions of dollars in loot that they took during World War II. As we've seen in, among other programs, For the Record 427, 428, 446, 451, and most recently 502, that war loot was used for a number of different funds, which in turn were used for a number of different purposes. They were used to fund World War II or Cold War covert operations. They were used to manipulate the Japanese political scene in a big, big way, and some of the money from the largest of the looting programs, Operation Golden Lily, has been used for various international power political machinations, including funding a private U.S. national security establishment for the far right, and buying off initially elements of the Chinese in order to cool down politics in Asia, that at a time when the elder George Bush was U.S. ambassador to Japan. The point being that the issue of Japan's World War II atrocities is very much on the front burner today. It is on the front burner because some of the fading survivors of World War II in the Pacific have sued the Japanese for, again, compensation for their use as slave laborers, and indeed the Japanese atrocities of World War II are being erased by the far right in Japan, and the cover-up of Japan's World War II atrocities is being aided and abetted by elements in the U.S., elements of the national security and political establishments that we wish to retain Japan as a strategic ally and wish to cover up the profound wrongdoings that were done during the course of the Cold War to maintain that situation, and also because of the profound links between American corporate interests and allied politicians and the Japanese corporations and allied politicians, assessing those corporations for World War II slave labor compensation cuts across some very, very profound relationships. The late Iris Chang's work was cutting across those profound relationships. She allegedly committed suicide in early November of 2004. As we're going to see, there is reason to ask questions about the circumstances surrounding her death. We're going to begin by taking a look at the extent to which the Japanese atrocities of World War II are on the front burner politically. As I'm speaking at the beginning of May of 2005, there has been a great deal of heat recently between the Japanese and Chinese, specifically over Japan's revisionist history in its World War II textbooks, or textbooks covering the World War II period. The idea is that basically the Japanese have been engaging in official, more or less government-sanctioned Holocaust denial, and the Chinese are protesting it. And as we're going to see in the LA Times article that I'm going to begin the broadcast with, the late Iris Chang's work was exemplary of the shedding of light on the reality of Japanese World War II conduct, and that shedding of light has upset some very, very dark forces indeed. We're going to take a look at the deep politics and deep history surrounding Japanese atrocities, the Japanese looting of Asia, and how that bears on the post-World War II and Cold War national security scene, and also the post-World War II corporate situation as well. And again, we're going to take a look at information suggesting at least the distinct possibility that because Iris Chang was swimming against the power political tides, her death may not have been the unassisted suicide that we're told it was. First article from the LA Times of April 11th, 2005. This is an op-ed column by Philip J. Cunningham. It's titled Japan's Revisionist History, and it reads as follows. The United States, ever quick to criticize China for human rights abuses, has of late been remarkably silent about Japan's ethical lapses, current and historical. Japanese politicians and publishers have made a cottage industry of denying the 1937 Nanking massacre, in which the Japanese killed hundreds of thousands of civilians in the old Chinese capital. This is an offense to Chinese sensibilities comparable with Holocaust denial in Europe. In recent months, major publishers and broadcasters have been bullied to conform and self-censor in accord with the rising tide of resurgent militarism. That tacit government approval is given to such xenophobic right-wing thinking can be seen in the latest Ministry of Education-approved school texts that erase or evade critical lessons drawn from Japan's bad behavior in its war of aggression. In the new history textbook, unquote, the Nanking Massacre is dismissed as a controversial incident, unquote, and the war of invasion is no longer termed an invasion. New textbooks drop references to comfort women, sex slaves of mostly Chinese and Korean origin who were forced to service Japanese fighting men in the field. To borrow a phrase from the late writer Iris Chang, the abused women are being raped a second time, this time by defenders of the Japanese army who attempt to erase them from memory. Note again that Iris Chang, not in addition to publicizing the reality of the Nanking massacre, the rape of Nanking, was also focusing attention on the plight of surviving comfort women and their attempts at getting compensation from the Japanese. And, as we will see, she was focusing also on the situation of the survivors of the Bataan Death March in the Philippines. Many of them were forced to work as slave laborers for Japanese corporations, and many of them also were involved in helping to build some of the facilities in which the billions upon billions of dollars in gold, bullion, and jewels were stored in underground vaults in the Philippines as part of Operation Golden Lily. The overall estimate of loot stash in the Philippines by the Japanese in World War II was upwards of $100 billion in early 1940s dollars. And as we saw, again, in For the Record programs 427, 428, 446, 451, and 502, that loot was used in part to finance World War II covert operations and also to manipulate the Japanese political landscape in the post-war period in a direction that was deemed optimum, at least from some people's standpoints, for prosecuting the Cold War. Returning once again to this article. So again, note that the late Iris Chang, in addition to focusing attention on the Nanking massacre and the comfort women, was working on the issue of the Bataan Death March survivors. Continuing with the editorial, China and the U.S. were allies in World War II, each contributing in its own way to the defeat of Japanese militarism. But the Cold War saw the U.S. turn away from China and embrace Japan, with the result that China's vast suffering, estimated at 20 million dead, was never properly memorialized or recognized by its erstwhile ally. To add insult to injury, the U.S. found it expedient to work with Emperor Hirohito and other war criminals of that era in order to facilitate occupation and bolster its anti-communism crusade. Now that the Cold War is over, It's high time that the U.S. lends support to China's valid historical complaints. But Japanese Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi, who has linked his political fate with the unrepentant rightists at home, and President Bush's policy abroad, keeps the unholy alliance functioning, offering vocal support for U.S. aggression in Iraq, while hailing Japan's fallen military heroes of a bygone era. As if to secure U.S. complacency on controversial textbook changes, U.S. actions in Iraq have been sanitized by Japanese textbook committees that, for instance, whited out unilateral, unquote, from a recent text. The cozy Tokyo-Washington relationship makes it difficult for the U.S. to take a judicious stand on anti-China antics such as history textbook revision. Last October, while Koizumi was lending vocal support to Bush in the presidential race and the war in Iraq, Shueisha, one of Japan's leading publishers, suspended publication of an acclaimed historical manga or comic book, My Country is Burning, unquote, for its unflinching portrayal of the Nanking Massacre. That, again, was during October of 2004 during the U.S. presidential campaign. Iris Chang allegedly committed suicide in early November, 1 month later. We're going to take a look at some of the things that were going on at that time later. In Beijing last week, Japanese Ambassador Kurashige Inami defended the publishing of right-wing textbooks as a testament to Japan's freedom of speech and publication, unquote. Why, then, was veteran manga artist Motomiya Hiroshi forced to retract and apologize for My Country is Burning? Why, then, did the NHK TV network, after getting a high-level warning, preemptively cut short a program on comfort women that laid blame on the emperor? If a Chinese internet cafe gets closed down, it's front-page news. Why isn't the U.S. equally concerned about setbacks to free speech in Japan? The U.S. should not look the other way in the face of resurgent Japanese militarism, even though a Japan freed of the constraints of its own reprehensible past behavior might serve to keep China on edge or might add muscle to the U.S. policing of the world. The ultimate consequence of whitewashing the past could be the demise of Japan's admirable peace constitution, allowing Japan to retool its formidable industrial base into a weapons industry threatening its neighbors, and possibly triggering an unprecedented arms race and another world war. So again, note that the investigations in which Iris Chang had been engaged, her book on the rape of Nanking, her investigations and publicizing of the comfort women's plight, and her investigations into the trials and tribulations and suffering of the survivors of the Bataan Death March, that cut across some very powerful relationships, the history of Cold War covert operations, the relationships between American and Japanese multinational corporations, and allied politicians on both sides of the Pacific, and also, as indicated in that editorial, that op-ed column, I should say, Japan's support for George Bush and the Iraqi adventure, and that in turn appears to be used, being manipulated as something of a diplomatic and political coin that is being exchanged for looking the other way on Japan's revisionist history. The following piece about Iris Chang's death, something of a cover-up, but somewhat revealing in spite of the fact that the basic spin is poor Iris was really depressed, and it's a shame she couldn't gain control of what she was doing and blew her brains out. She did blow her brains out, apparently, but one wonders. There's reason to suspect that her suicide may have been, quote, assisted, unquote, either by some form of mind control or manipulation of her use of antidepressant drugs. Iris Chang was depressed. On the other hand, she was getting death threats. And we're going to take a look at the context in which she was operating. And when people get death threats, it does tend to have a depressing effect. Doesn't mean that people are going to kill themselves. The following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, April 17th of 2005, an article by Heidi Benson called "Historian Iris Chang Won Many Battles. The war she lost raged within." The piece is something of a cover-up, perhaps unintentionally so. Nonetheless, it's revealing, but it also is sort of disgusting in some ways. Now, again, as seen in that last op-ed piece, the focal point of much controversy now between Japan and China is Japan's conduct during World War II, its whitewashing of the comfort women, its whitewashing of the rape of Nanking, both subjects covered by Iris Chang, and also, as we're going to see, another sensitive factor concerns the Japanese corporation's use of slave labor. And again, remember Operation Golden Lily and the machinations we've covered in so many different broadcasts dealing with the book Gold Warriors. After Iris Chang wrote The Rape of Nanking, she was basically subjected to some really, really, really unpleasant retribution. Following the rape, her publication of The Rape of Nanking, the Heidi Benson story goes on, skipping down. At the same time, torrents of hate mail came in, Brett said. Brett is the late Iris Chang's husband. Continuing, Iris is sensitive, but she got charged up, he recalled. When anybody questioned the validity of what she wrote, she would respond with overwhelming evidence to back it up. She's very much a perfectionist. It was hard for her not to react every single time. Most of the attacks came from Japanese ultranationalists. We saw cartoons where she was portrayed as this woman with a great big mouth, Brett said. She got used to the fact that there was a website called Iris Chang and Her Lies. She would just laugh. But friends say Iris began to voice concern for her safety. She believed her phone was tapped. She described finding threatening notes on her car. She said she was confronted by a man who said, "You will not continue writing this," unquote. She used a post office box, never her home address, for mail. There are a fair number of people who don't take kindly to what she wrote in The Rape of Nanking, Brett said. So she's always been very, very private about our family life, unquote. The book's popularity meant a lengthy book tour. Over a year and a half, she visited 65 cities, Brett said. Most authors are worn out after 5 or 6 cities, unquote. He could see the travel was taking a toll on her. In 1998, Brett recalled, for her 30th birthday, we went out to a little resort near Santa Cruz, and she literally didn't want to leave the room. Somehow, she always bounced back, energized by her role as a spokesperson for a movement. Among her many television appearances was a memorable evening on Nightline where she was the only Asian and the only woman among a panel of China experts. To see her on TV defending Rape of Nanking so fiercely and so fearlessly, I just sat down, stopped in awe, said Helen Zia, author of Asian American Dreams, Emergence of an American People, and co-author with Wen Ho Lee of My Country Versus Me, the first-hand account of the Los Alamos scientist who was falsely accused. Iris had no fear. You could see it in the steadiness of her voice and in her persistence, Zia recalled. She would just say matter-of-factly, "Japan is lying, and here's why," unquote. Later, Iris challenged the Japanese ambassador to a debate on the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour on PBS. After the ambassador spoke of events in Nanking, Iris turned to the moderator and said, "I didn't hear an apology," unquote. And again, note that Iris Chang was pretty brave and pretty resilient. Also note that there were some pretty nasty people making noises in her regard. Now, about another of the projects that she was undertaking, which cut right across this power axis that we are examining. Again, it was relevant to political relations and the international scale today, the profound history of post-World War II Cold War covert operations, and the global macroeconomics of Japanese and American transnational corporations, and allied political interests. Again, when Iris was, at the time of her death, she was working on the story of the survivors of the Bataan Death March of World War II. Skipping down again in this article by Heidi Benson, but soon she found herself drawn to a subject just as dark. Iris Chang rang the doorbell on Ed Martell's front porch in Kenosha, Wisconsin on December 4th, 2003. It's a date he won't forget. Quote, "She sat down and cross-examined me like a district attorney for 5 solid hours," unquote, said Martell, 86, one of the last remaining survivors of the Bataan Death March of World War II. His daughter Maddie remembered the day well, too. "We set out a very big lunch, meat trays and sandwiches and desserts," she said. "My dad was so excited that she was doing this and so honored," unquote. Months earlier, Iris had seized on a letter in her book ideas file about a Midwestern pocket of Bataan survivors, all members of 2 tank battalions. "They dropped so fast," the letter had read. The correspondent was Sergeant Anthony Meldahl, a supply sergeant with the Ohio National Guard who had admired Iris's work. Meldahl was now urging Iris to join his oral history project. She did, and starting in November 2003 would make 4 trips to meet with Bataan vets in Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, and Kentucky. Each time Iris swept into town and conducted 4 or 5 intensive interviews in as many days. She was like a battalion commander, Meldahl said. It's amazing when you watch Iris do research, Brett said. She would go into a town, and with Tony Meldahl's help, it was even better. She would have a team of 3 vets and their children and their wives. Iris would be interviewing them, somebody else would be filming them, and somebody else would be photocopying records, and somebody would be sending documents down to UPS. And Iris would buy lunch and dinner for everybody, and they all thought it was great. These people wanted their story told for a long, long time, and they knew that because Iris had success as an author, she'd be able to do a very good job, Brett said. Ed Martell's story began on December 7, 1941. Pearl Harbor was still smoldering when Japanese planes bombed the Philippines' Bataan Peninsula, where Martell was stationed with a National Guard tank battalion. With few rations, little ammunition, and no reinforcements, 70,000 American and Filipino troops held off the Japanese for months. When the American generals surrendered on April 9th, the Japanese forced the troops to walk 65 miles through sweltering jungle. Some 8,000 died on the notorious Death March. Those who survived spent the rest of the war in a bleak prison camp. Some were shipped to Japan as slave laborers. Note that. Once the Allies won the war, the story was forgotten. It had been the largest U.S. Army surrender in history. Quote, "It's baffling to me that the U.S. today has so little knowledge of the 4 months we held out," Martell told the Chronicle by telephone from his home in Wisconsin. "We marvel at how America turned their backs on us," unquote. Martell was slightly hard of hearing, but his memory was crisp. He recalled telling Iris about the worst of his Bataan experiences. "Iris asked me to tell about atrocities," he said. "Twice I broke down and had to leave the room." Among the things that would happen, for example, an American prisoner would be instructed to bury a fellow who had collapsed of exhaustion or malnutrition alive. If he refused, another prisoner was forced to bury him alive. And that's just a small example of the kinds of things that took place. Now we're going to take a look at the toll this took on Iris Chang. She was feeling depressed, but we're going to take a look at a mysterious sojourn that she had at Norton Psychiatric Hospital in Louisville. This with the help of a colonel whom she'd gone to interview. She later was afraid of this colonel, and as we're going to see in her suicide note, she felt that this tour, this stay in the psychiatric hospital, her encounter with the colonel, were somehow connected with retribution, possibly even by the CIA, against her. I would suggest that perhaps that not only is that a possibility, but another possibility, either and or, would be that Japanese elements were basically working against her. And it may very well be, too, that Iris Chang's agitating, so to speak, her investigations were deemed unuseful in the contemporary national security environment. So again, Japanese or American or both elements appear to have been working against her. Continuing, "I knew Iris was not right," her mother said. "She couldn't eat or drink. She was very depressed," unquote. She asked if Iris had any friends there she could call for help. One of the veterans, a colonel she'd planned to meet in Louisville, came to the hotel. Smith said the colonel spent only a short time with her. Quote, "She was afraid of him when he showed up," Smith said, but he spoke to her mother on the phone and told Iris, "Your mama's on the phone, so it's okay," unquote. That afternoon, she checked herself into Norton Psychiatric Hospital in Louisville with help from the colonel. Through a third party, the colonel declined to be interviewed. First, they gave her an antipsychotic stabilizer, her mother said. For 3 days, they gave her medication, the first time in her life. The family would not name specific drugs. Then again, Iris killed herself just before Veterans Day in November of 2004. And about her suicide notes, we read the following. Then she wrote a suicide note addressed to her parents, Brett, and her brother, followed by a lengthy revision. The first draft said, "When you believe you have a future, you think in terms of generations and years. When you do not, you live not just by the day, but by the minute. It is far better that you remember me as I was in my heyday as a best-selling author than the wild-eyed wreck who returned from Louisville. Each breath is becoming difficult for me to take. The anxiety can be compared to drowning in an open sea. I know that my actions will transfer some of this pain to others, indeed those who love me the most. Please forgive me. Forgive me because I cannot forgive myself." In the final version, she added, "There are aspects of my experience in Louisville that I will never understand. Deep down, I suspect that you may have more answers about this than I do. I can never shake my belief that I was being recruited and later persecuted by forces more powerful than I could have imagined. Whether it was the CIA or some other organization, I will never know. As long as I am alive, these forces will never stop hounding me. Days before I left for Louisville, I had a deep foreboding about my safety. I sensed suddenly threats to my own life, an eerie feeling that I was being followed in the streets, the white van parked outside my house, damaged mail arriving at my P.O. box. I believe my detention at Norton Hospital was the government's attempt to discredit me. I had considered running away, but I will never be able to escape from myself and my thoughts. I'm doing this because I'm too weak to withstand the years of pain and agony ahead, unquote. And it then goes on to say, the article, after Iris Chang's Oldsmobile was found off Highway 17 on Tuesday morning, November 9th, the California Highway Patrol was called to the scene. The Highway Patrol then called the Santa Clara Sheriff's Homicide Unit, and Detective Sergeant Dean Baker, a 33-year veteran, took over the investigation. There is an aspect of paranoia in the majority of suicides, Baker said. A lot of people, depending on how disturbed they are, feel that people are plotting against them, unquote. One thing that we're going to take a look at is what Iris Chang communicated to a college friend of hers shortly before her suicide. The following is from Salon.com, article by Paula Kamen, dated November 30th of 2004, How Iris Chang Became a Verb. And Iris Chang called Paula Kamen, a longtime friend dating to their college days in Illinois, this shortly before her death. Over the next hour, I stumbled to ask her about what had happened. She had talked about her overwhelming fear and anxieties, including being unable to face the magnitude and the controversial nature of the stories that she had uncovered. Her current, vaguely described problems were, quote, external, unquote, she kept repeating, a result of her controversial research. They weren't a result of the, quote, internal, unquote, that is, they weren't all in her head. I asked her about what others in her life thought about the cause of this apparent depression. She paused and said, quote, they think it's internal, unquote. So again, note that in this conversation with a good friend, she said she thought that her problems were external, that is to say, real and in the physical world. Others thought they were internal, i.e. in her head. And note that in her suicide note, she somehow felt that her stay at that psychiatric hospital, courtesy of the colonel, was somehow connected with retribution against her. We're going to continue with this in the second side of this program. Remember, the Spitfire website, Spitfire stocks all of the CDs that I've recorded over the years, lectures and programs. Regular mail, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfirelist, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T, at hotmail.com. There are, probably at this point, thousands of pages of printed material available online. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning, available in both Adobe PDF and HTML, is available for download for free on the website. Long written article length descriptions of the For the Record shows, usually up within a couple of weeks of the airing of the broadcast, are also available on the Spitfire website. In addition, the Spitfire website is equipped with a search function and also with a page to click on for people to support the work that I'm doing. And also, please note links to two websites maintained by the heroic sister station WFMU, which is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio and now MP3 as well. More recent programs available at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older shows available at a longer URL, link to both that website and the Real Audio and MP3-equipped Spitfire website as well. From that website, you can also download the most recently recorded shows. Please note also that WFMU is podcasting the For the Record shows as well at the beginning of the more recent descriptions, and also on the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery website, there is a place to click on to get information about how to have WFMU podcast the For the Records to you. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 509, The Death of Iris Chang, being recorded on May 1st of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.